Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it's August 10th, 2017. Glad to have you along for this edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Joining us on the line from Asheville and NPR member station WCQS, Blue Ridge Public Media, is Jeremy Loeb. Jeremy, hey there, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. Good to be with you, Jeff. I'm excited to be on your podcast. I've listened to it a number of times already, and you're doing a nice job with it.
I appreciate it. Glad to have you here. I'm going to start with a curveball, because why not? WCQS, Blue Ridge Public Media, both, neither. How do I not screw this up moving forward?
Yeah, you did kind of screw it up a little bit, yeah, but that's right. Okay. Great. It's Blue Ridge Public Radio now.
Okay.
And so we rebranded. We used to be called WCQS. Now we are WCQS and BPR News, so we added an all news station, and so now we have rebranded as Blue Ridge Public Radio, and we go by BPR. Don't ask me where the R went. We're just BPR.
BPR. Like NPR, yep. BPR.
Yeah, that's what they wanted, I'm sure.
All right. The tally counter of my mistakes is at one. That's an early one. We'll see if we can keep those limited moving forward. Big story this week, and we're going to get to a number of things on the podcast today. We're going to chat about Congressman Mark Meadows, cuts to legal services, throw some questions at Jeremy about his time here at WUNC, where you used to be a morning edition producer. But let's start with the big story of the week, which was redistricting and lawmakers passed criteria on Thursday for which they'll use the criteria to draw new maps, and new maps, of course, are due on September 1st. This comes out of illegal racial gerrymandering and redistricting. Maps have to be redrawn. This is not something that we don't expect, at least, it to directly affect the Buncombe, Henderson, Western Mountain area that you live in. But what tabs were you keeping on this week?
Well, you know, I'm watching redistricting, of course, because I have the keen interest in what goes on statewide. I tend to focus on Raleigh quite a bit. But we're talking about, of course, 28 districts, statewide legislative districts. And so we don't expect many changes to Western North Carolina districts. These are going to affect the central and eastern parts of the state more so. But we're talking about one case here. We're talking about the state legislative races, and it's just one of many that are going on. Obviously, there's challenges all over the country to redistricting and gerrymandering. And so what would be more significant to the western part of the state are if there are any changes to our congressional maps. We are represented by two congressmen right now. They are Representative Mark Meadows and Representative Patrick McHenry. That's the 10th and the 11th district. They kind of split Asheville in half. And so right now we have two very conservative districts here in the western part of the state. And I don't want to get too far off the current case, but that's what we're looking at here in the western part of the state. Of course, we're keeping our eye on those legislative districts, though, as well.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. Redistricting, again, timeline of September 1st. The plaintiffs in this case who sued over maps that were passed in 2011, Southern Coalition for Social Justice, they sued based on, their claims that African-American voters were packed into, several districts, 28 districts to be precise. They won that case. And as these maps get passed, it will go back before the three judges the judges are most likely going to hear from Southern Coalition for Social Justice. They can object to the new maps, and it's going to be interesting to see how this whole thing plays out. We're certainly in the weeds on this, and I think that an important factor in all this, or an important factor in how it's considered, is how the judges look at the fact that lawmakers are not going to use race as a consideration, a criteria, as they draw these new maps. So that was something that was decided this week. And there's much more on redistricting. Again, nuanced, wonky. You can see more at our website, wunc.org. We did a story this week about some of the possible double bunkings and other opportunity districts. And, I mean, there's a lot to it. Jeremy, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that was interesting, not to get too into the weeds, but the story this morning out of the AP, and I'm sure that you reported on it as well, was that we got down to criteria, and they were looking at partisan reasons for doing redistricting, or basically saying that this can be a criteria that we look at, but we're not going to look at race. And I know that some were saying, you know, this whole case was about race. So how can you not look at race when you're trying to correct illegally racially gerrymandered districts? I understand their point, but I don't know how they correct that without actually looking at the racial data.
One of the points of consternation for conservatives and Republicans, at least in this cycle, I mean, I think that Democrats, when they were in power or are in power in other parts of the country, have had this challenge as well. One of the problems Republicans have faced, and one of their gripes, is they take race into consideration and they're told, you didn't do it enough. And then they take race into consideration. And what they did in 2011 was they did indeed put a lot of African-American voters in 28 districts, or a small number of districts relative to the 170 across the state. And their position is, well, now we took race into account even further, and now we're getting hammered for it again. We lost a court case because of it. They say they would like to see a more clear directive from the courts about, oh, hey, you need to consider race, and this is how much, or this is how you do it. The courts, from my perspective, have not done that. And that kind of muddies the water a little bit here. And I don't know what the answer is in terms of how to consider race, to what extent, when to consider race. From my perspective, it seems pretty darn complicated.
Yeah, and we also have the same players involved. It's David Lewis and Ralph Heiss, I think, who are leading the charge on drawing those maps. Ralph Heiss is one of our lawmakers out here in Western North Carolina. He represents Spruce Pine and Mitchell County and a number of counties, actually. I think it's like seven counties that he represents. But they're also tasking the same guy. I think his name is
Hoffler,
Thomas Hoffeller. Yeah. And that guy's basically the guy who drew the maps before, and he's going to be doing it again.
Right, right. And this is also has been a point of criticism from some about the fact that the consultant who advised the Republicans here in North Carolina 6 years ago is back again. And Hoffler is, from what I gather, I have not met him, but he is widely considered the guy when it comes to redistricting. And they brought him in because he's very good. He's widely respected. Or widely, maybe not respected on both sides, but he's widely known for what he does. So a lot more to come on redistricting. We will see what the new maps look like by the end of the month. We'll hear perhaps an objection to those maps from the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. And we really don't even know at this point how many seats are going to be changed. But it's interesting. It's going to have an effect on the 2018 election I think it's going to be more interesting. They're going to be more competitive districts, and there's more of a gray area in the North Carolina House where Republicans are trying to hang on to the supermajority. And if it's a long way away, so I don't put too much stock in, you know, oh, it's going to be a historically bad year for Republicans. Who knows where we're at with things in 15 months, right? But I think there's also—
Things change so fast.
Right,
though.
Right. So anyway, I'm rambling.
I think you're going to be looking at maps for a while, though, Jeff, and definitely over the next few weeks. So I don't envy you that.
I would agree with you there. All right, for more on redistricting, check out stories on our website from this week, WUNC.org. You mentioned Patrick McHenry and Mark Meadows, and you and I have chatted before. I've gone on with you. You host Morning Edition out at mm-hmm. BPR, and we've chatted about North Carolina politics a number of times. And I guess maybe not as struck anymore. I think it's interesting that you have two really powerful members of the U.S. House who come from Western North Carolina. And that's not to disparage Western North Carolina, right? But this is not an area I don't think that people generally think of as having a lot of political influence. But at this moment in American politics, at least in Congress, you've got Patrick McHenry, who's he's the number three with Steve Scalise out. Otherwise, he's like the number four member of the U.S. House, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't think people would disagree with you. It is a little strange, I think. And it comes largely from, like you said, you know, the fact that we've got a guy basically acting whip right now in the U.S. House. And then we also have Mark Meadows, who is kind of a, you know, he's like a Tea Party guy who is now the chair of the Freedom Caucus. And, you know, your listeners have probably heard a lot about the Freedom Caucus lately, of course, because of the healthcare debate and how much of a role they played in shaping that legislation. Mark Meadows has formed quite an alliance, from what I understand, with the president, and has a pretty direct line to him. and has had his ear on a number of things. And so he was really influential in the healthcare debate in the House. As you might remember, he voted against the original version of the House bill. And so people were thinking, oh, my God, Mark Meadows is going to bury the healthcare bill. But then, of course, he ultimately voted for the House version. Of course, the Senate version failed ultimately. But Mark Meadows is not giving up. You know, there are a number of lawmakers out across the country who are saying that they're still working on healthcare. And of course, President Trump is tweeting, you know, I think even this morning about healthcare. Mm-hmm. So they're not giving it up.
So Meadows, as you mentioned, head of the Freedom Caucus, he has this proverbial lever that he can pull. I think there are between 35 and 40 Republicans at this point in the Freedom Caucus. And if he cranks that lever, so to speak, he can grind anything to a halt within the U.S. House and keep policy from moving forward. So a fascinating political character from my perspective. But he was back in the district earlier this week. He had a town hall meeting in Flat Rock. This is, the internet tells me, an idyllic mountain community about 40 minutes south of Asheville.
It was nice.
So you were there. You tell me about this town hall meeting. What was, just give me a snapshot of it.
Yeah, well, Flat Rock, by the way, is about 30 minutes south of Asheville. It's closest to Hendersonville, and that's the home of Blue Ridge Community College, where this was held. So this was about 400 people at the town hall. Mark Meadows was there, of course. And so, yeah, I went, and I believe it was, you know, I don't know the exact numbers, but I would say it was about 50-50 his supporters versus people who were there to basically protest. And the town hall, I would say, I was struck by... Some people might be surprised by this because there were some loud moments, but I was struck more by the civility of the town hall than I was about the actual protests. But that's not to say that people weren't there and were upset. They were. And a lot of people basically raised their voices. This town hall was dominated by healthcare. It was a two-hour town hall. The first half of the town hall was almost entirely on healthcare, and then it got off onto some other topics. But... you know, there were a lot of people on the left who were very upset about the push for repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. And then there were a lot of people on the right who supported Mark, and they were there with their signs saying, thank you, Mark. And so what struck me the most, I think, about that town hall was you and I, you know, we talked about a week before this town hall, and I had asked you, what do you think, Jeff? Do you think they're going to pay a price for these votes of, you know, taking these votes against the Affordable Care Act, and then this bill ultimately failed? And you predicted, you weren't really sure whether there was going to be any kind of backlash. And what struck me is there didn't seem to be any backlash from the right. There weren't those people that were upset that the healthcare push had failed. At least they weren't vocalizing it. They were there to support Mark pretty clearly.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So you mentioned the civility, which I guess is an encouraging footnote in the moment of American politics that we're in. Elaborate a little bit on. I mean, were people pleasant to one another? Were they shaking
hands?
Well,
I mean, there was definitely opposition. I mean, I heard a few stray comments here and there, but largely what it was is that the people on the left would vigorously disapprove of something. They would start yelling out. You know, it did kind of break down a few times, but largely. It was on topic. You know, people weren't there chanting, protesting. They were there to hear from Mark Meadows and to question him. And so it really stayed on topic. And I'll say this about Mark Meadows. He seems to be a very skilled politician. Regardless of what you think about his politics, he really does give people a chance to speak. So if people are arguing against him, he really does give them their time. At least he did in this town hall. And so what I've seen from Mark Meadows is that this is a guy who believes in the civility of politics. I've seen that on, you know, phone conferences that I've had with him before, where he gives all the reporters a chance to speak and ask tough questions. And so I don't think that's true of a lot of politicians. And it may be surprising to some of your listeners coming from the guy who's the chair of the Freedom Caucus, which I'm sure a lot of them think of as disruptors. But this isn't a guy that at least, you know, in terms of how he carries himself publicly, it presents himself that way.
I would agree. I've met the congressman a couple of times, and I don't know what the opposite of thin-skinned is. I mean, I guess it's thick-skinned, but I mean, I'm not like going to the congressman and lobbying complaints or necessarily being difficult with him. He strikes me as he's not thin-skinned. I don't know if there's necessarily a tit for tat on that. But
yeah.
He's pretty welcoming with his time. I've never had an issue walking up with him. And yeah, some politicians certainly brush you off or are dismissive of you or your questions for whatever reason.
I do think that is a rare quality these days because we do get brushed off by a lot of politicians who don't want to talk to us. And
right.
I won't name any names, but you know that is a common occurrence. So when you do have someone who is more giving with his time, it is refreshing, and so it is helpful. And I think, you know, as chair of the Freedom Caucus, he's probably no stranger to tough questions, and so he can handle them. But yeah, that's my impression of that. And the town hall itself, you know, it got off onto another a number of topics. Well, one was the debt ceiling. He kind of alluded to, you know, you talked about his strength, but there's also some weakness there, actually, because he talked about, you know, the likelihood that the debt ceiling would be raised mostly with Democratic votes and with some Republicans. So while he kind of alluded to the fact that he wanted to see spending cuts to go along with the debt ceiling being raised, he kind of said the most likely thing that will occur here is that the Democrats will vote for this. Now, that's, you know, who knows what's going to happen, but that's what he kind of alluded to.
Right. No, that would be my basic expectation as well. And you're talking about a bipartisan effort, most likely, that Meadows on the far right would be opposed to. What else, before we get too far away from it, Medicare, health care for the elderly, Medicaid, health care for the indigent folks who are poor. What was the conversation like around those two at the
town
hall?
Into the weeds to the point where, you know, you start to get bogged down a little bit. But he was basically saying that there's these four approaches that they're looking at still. Of course, one is repealing the Affordable Care Act. One is Medicaid for all or Medicare for all. And then he garnered a lot of boos from the people who were there to protest when he mentioned block grants for the states. So he's talking about, you know, basically giving the states more control over, you know, how they dole out this money. But it is pretty striking how much the conversation has shifted from, you know, basically cutting Obamacare out entirely to now we are talking about, you know, how many people can be enrolled in Medicaid and Medicare. And also, you know, he also said, you know, I will not vote for anything that will preclude protections for pre-existing conditions. So just in the 7 years that Obamacare was passed, the conversation really has changed a lot as to what we expect from healthcare. And I'm not saying that that's, you know, basically what he prefer, but I think that he's looking at the things that are politically feasible. And it may be that it's no longer politically feasible to just cut Obamacare. I mean, obviously we saw that vote take place and it didn't happen.
Sure. Jeremy Loeb is the guest here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. He hosts Morning Edition and covers politics as well. Out for Blue Ridge Public Radio, which is based in Asheville. I want to work through several more things here, and we'll try to do it perhaps a little bit more quickly because I have a bunch of more questions here in front of me.
Sure.
Pisgah Legal Services is another story that you've spent some time on this week, and the quick background from my seat is that budget cuts were made to three different legal service entities across the state, including one in the western part. Tell us a little bit about that story. How much money did they lose, and what are some of the effects?
Well, and then I don't want to misrepresent it. Basically, I had an interview this morning, so that's the extent of my work on it. But this morning I did speak to Jim Barrett, and he is the executive director of Pisgah Legal Services. They are a group that provides legal assistance for free for people who need it. And they are one of three groups across the state that were hit by budget cuts in the state budget. And I remember about a week ago, it was Gary Robertson from the Associated Press put out a story talking about legal aid cuts. And in his headline, it was, "It's not clear why." And so I asked Jim Barrett if he knew why. You know, when did you find out about these cuts? He said, well, you know, it was a surprise to me. I didn't hear about it. He's had no contact with lawmakers. He's had none. And so it's pretty striking that this just happened, and it is significant. Essentially, this is a service that was cut in the last budget, I believe, by about $2 million. And this time cut was about $1.3 million. I may have those numbers wrong, but that's what I'm doing off the top of my head here.
Okay.
And the effects to Pisgah Legal are pretty significant. He said that they serve about 15,000 to 18,000 people, and this could mean that they serve 2,000 fewer people. And so it's really significant. I believe we're talking about $500,000 to Pisgah Legal itself. Pisgah Legal does a lot more, though, than provide legal aid. They also try to enroll people in the Affordable Care Act. They have a service for that. They provide service for the homeless, try to keep people off the streets, and they also do service for people who are victims of domestic violence and abuse and things like that. And so this is a group that, of course, you know, they're on a mission, and their mission has been hit pretty hard. And it is unclear why, as Gary Robertson said, we don't know. We don't understand why. And in his reporting, they kind of jumped back and forth, and nobody was owning the cuts. And basically people were saying, well, ask Tim Moore, you know, the House Speaker. And I think they kind of pointed the finger back at somebody else and said, ask them. So it's like nobody knows why this happened.
Well, somebody knows, but no one's forthcoming at this point.
Yeah, and not to stray off topic too much, but I thought this was interesting. You know, we've just had this cut to the Department of Justice. As Josh Stein has been lobbying out there, he's had to lay off 40 people from the Department of Justice. He's been out there trying to raise this subject. Mm-hmm. They took away $10 million there. So a lot of hits to the legal community. And as a lot of people are noting, both Tim Moore and Phil Berger are lawyers. So they would know what kind of impact this would have.
It is certainly part of the... And the question of why, this is the one that will gnaw at you as a political reporter. And certainly... It can be very frustrating. I mean, sometimes you just want a why. You want a simple why. You want somebody to say, oh, this is the reason behind it. I mean, we heard with Stein, I've chatted with Senator Berger about this a couple of times. He and Speaker Moore maintain that Josh Stein has adequate funding to do criminal prosecutions, criminal investigations where needed. And then, you know, the subtext or sometimes the next stanza is, and the attorney general, the current one and the last one, now the governor, Roy Cooper, have chosen not to defend some cases where they should have. And this is, you know, one of the areas of conflict between the Democratic attorney generals and the Republican leaders in the legislature. But yes, sometimes the why, sometimes the if you're going to cut something, whether it's, you know, $20 from your grocery budget or $2 million from your legal aid budget, from a point of transparency, which is the place I generally come from, it would be nice to have more of an articulated reason on some of these budget cuts sometimes, right? Or some of these budget expenditures. We can go the other way with it, I suppose.
And we're talking about significant cuts to programs, but when you look at the actual budget, I mean, I think you may know the figure. It's probably $22 or $23 billion. So we're talking about a very small amount from the actual budget. And so if they're looking to save money, it probably doesn't make these groups feel any better because they're looking at the budget and saying, we're just this one little tiny part. If you're trying to save money, why is it coming from this essential service?
Jeremy Loeb from Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm going to fire a few at you here in somewhat rapid succession. You're a morning edition host. I did this for years. I despised it by the end because I was getting up at 4 in the morning. I would push it sometimes to like 4:30 and roll into the studio at like 4:52 for a 4:59 on-air check. What time do you get up and how much do you love or hate the early mornings?
Oh, man. Well, I've been hosting Morning Edition for 2.5 years now in Asheville. I was doing it for a year before that in Alabama. And as you mentioned, I was the morning producer for a while there at WUNC. So I've been doing it for a while. I am not a morning person. And that's tough because I have to be now. And it just tends to be that the morning host jobs are the ones that open up around the country. And so that's what you get. I set my alarm for 4:30.
Nice.
We don't start live at 5. I have some pre-recorded stuff going
on
there.
Good.
So I know at UNC you guys go right at 5. And so I get a little more leeway with sleeping in, but I roll into the station usually around 5:30.
Who do you miss most from WUNC?
Oh, man. Yeah, well, I didn't know you yet, Jeff.
All right.
I mean,
you didn't.
You know, I have a great relationship with David Brower and with Eric Hodge, obviously, who I worked with really closely. And Eric really, you know, I'll talk more about Eric because your listeners know him better. It could be because Eric really is the guy that you hear on the air. He's just a great guy. And like I said, and this was early on for me, mornings. I didn't like it getting up that early, but Eric really did make it fun to be there. He was always bubbly and fun to be with. We had this whole rivalry going about Duke and Carolina because I'm a Duke fan.
Oh, and so I didn't know you were a Duke fan. That's a big
I know that probably changed
you.
Things a little bit.
Continue, sorry.
Well, David Brower and Eric Hodge and I still to this day, when Duke and Carolina play, we will get ourselves a three-way phone text battle going. And I love doing it because I think that Eric doesn't really like texts, and so it's fun for me to send the text because then when I send it, he's going to get the ones from David as well. And it's just a lot of trash talk, and we have fun with that. So
I will offer this one note on Eric Hodge, our great, fantastic Morning Edition host. He grew up, I don't know how to say this correctly, he grew up on a farm. He's a farmer's kid.
Yeah, I should have mentioned.
And he's generally jacked up in the mornings. I think it's part caffeine, part just his wiring, his clock. And it's inspiring because generally by like 5:45, I'm ready to go back to bed. As a journalist, any cliches that you just hate and try to avoid?
Oh, you've blindsided me.
I have. That's the point
cliches.
Of this exercise.
It is. I don't know, Jeff. Well, let me hear your answer first. I'll turn it back around on you, and then maybe I'll come up with something.
That's not how this works. I don't like time will tell.
Time will tell. I'll tell you one thing.
That's one that immediately comes to mind.
Well, one that I've started doing, and so I find it annoying because I hear myself doing it all the time, and this is from print. It will, you know, you'll be explaining something, and then you'll say, indeed, comma,
yeah,
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, no, I don't
And
like
I've started
that.
Using that.
And one sports one is I don't like when people are like, oh, yeah, you know, we have a really talented news staff. We have the Jeremy Loebs of the world and the they pluralize individuals like they do this in sports. Right. And you're like, oh, you know, guys like Tom Brady. Like, no, there aren't guys like Tom. Like, he's the only one. Or like, oh, you know, the LeBron Jameses of this. No, there's not. There's just.
Yeah,
one.
Right. Yeah, that's just. Assigning too much responsibility to one person. Time will tell is a good one, though, because that's really just kind of a throwaway. It's like, we really just don't know.
Yeah.
And you might as well have just said, hey, guys, I don't know.
Right, stay tuned.
As I expect to do, you know, at some point on the podcast during the harder parts of your question, but you spared me some of the tough ones, I guess.
I had a couple more here. All right, two more, and then I'll leave you alone. Favorite local beer? And in addition to that, the follow-up is when's the best month to go visit the Buncombe County, Asheville region?
Oh, man. Well, best local beer right now, I've got to give it to Burial Brewery. I can't really pick a specific, though. It's just that they're overall, they've got great dark beers. They're located in South Slope, which is kind of this hotbed of breweries right now. They've got great dark brews, and they all have this kind of gothic, you know, medieval theme to them, you know.
And, like the marketing, and there aren't actually, like,
done,
ingredients from medieval.
Right, theory. Right. But they've done great jobs with their marketing, and they seem to just get the whole craft beer vibe. You know, that's a thing that I'm sure your listeners can just kind of understand. They've got a great patio out there. It's not too big yet. You know, a lot of breweries are getting pretty big. In Asheville, we love our independence, you know, so it's still, we can still drink our Burial guilt-free. But anyway, best month to come, this is definitely a great time right now because I hear it's 95 degrees or had been in Durham, and we were about 10 degrees cooler than that. And so while you were suffering, Jeff, I was basking in the great, clear, crisp mountain air with my Burial beer. You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate it. There are 205 craft breweries in North Carolina now. Asheville is home to more of them than anywhere else. Last check, I believe Asheville had more breweries per capita than anywhere in the country. That will do it for this edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. Jeremy, thank you for the time.
Yeah, it was really fun, Jeff. Hope we'll do it again.
And thank you for tuning into the program to get your policy fix. Give the Politics Podcast a rating on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever it is that you listen. You can subscribe there as well. And if you have questions or comments, you can tweet at us. Jeremy is at Jeremy_Loeb, L-O-E-B. I'm at J_Tibbs, T-I-B-S. For Jeremy, I'm Jeff. Enjoy your weekend.